I saw a bunch of the kids of my age carrying a baby to the edge of the cliff. And I went, I said, what are you doing? I said, we're going to throw him over the edge to see how he becomes a little dot like in the Roadrunner cartoon.
Oh, what? My God.
And I said, no, but he's going to die. And they said, no, no, he's going to bounce.
I'm Elijah Wood.
And I'm Daniel Noah.
Guillermo del Toro needs no introduction. The mind behind such classic genre films as The Devil's Backbone, Pan's Labyrinth, and Best Picture winner, The Shape of Water, Guillermo is a man whose heart is overflowing with generosity. And that generosity is what led him to offer us a few precious hours of his time in the midst of a grueling schedule.
We visited Guillermo at his storied Bleak House, a labyrinthine compound packed to the gills with his personal collection of art, books, props from iconic horror films, intimate keepsakes, and general ephemera. The collection was the basis of a stunning museum show that debuted at LACMA in 2016 and now travels the world. It's a collection that starts and ends with his father's personal library, a small curated selection of fantastical tales that offered an isolated boy in Guadalajara his first taste of horror and started him down the path to become the incredible man that he is today.
And remember, if you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen so you never miss an episode. This is Visitations.
With Elijah Wood.
And Daniel Noah.
And now, Guillermo del Toro.
Having you emailed him. This is one of these things where, like, he's never going to say yes, but we should ask, right? And you just fire off an email, and then what happened?
He responded very quickly, but it just became about how unearthly busy the man is.
Yeah. He has the same AOL email that he had in 2001 when I was in touch with him.
You're kidding.
No. The last AOL email in the world.
Yeah. That is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
How does AOL still exist?
I have no idea.
Does it? I mean, clearly it does.
Does he hear, you've got mail.
Right? See?
So you've not been to Bleak House before.
I have not, right? No.
And so this is where he keeps all of his stuff that he's collected, but a lot of it's on tour right now. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm curious to see how much of Bleak House actually exists in the space.
Yeah.
This is the house.
Is it? I imagined it would be.
Yeah, this is it.
Way up, like behind an iron gate with a hunchbacked assistant who lets you in.
No. Pretty cool. It's us.
It's Daniel and Elijah.
Oh, it's Fredo from The Godfather.
Hello again.
How are you?
Thanks for having us.
So that, you know, this is the horror library. The house is divided.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In 13 libraries. Mm-hmm. This is horror. This is all horror.
Yeah.
Then here starts science fiction in that shelf.
Mm-hmm.
Science fiction and fantasy here, and then ghosts.
Wow.
And again, this is ghosts factual and ghost literature.
Right.
You know? So you have...
So true hauntings.
True hauntings. And I mean, there's incredible... there's really, really great books on that.
I can imagine.
Yeah, it's... I mean, some of the guides are really fantastic.
Yeah.
And some of them are not so great, but...
Sure.
These are a lot of them when I was a kid.
Oh, wow.
They would be really scary for me to read.
Mm-hmm.
Let me read you one.
Supernatural England.
Yeah, because it has the photos.
Oh wow!
It's a guy. When I was in London the first time, I went to
a few of those places,
all the haunted places in London. And then you know, I always stay in the haunted hotels. We talked about this.
Yeah.
And I've never had anything happen except in New Zealand.
Except that one place, yeah.
In New Zealand, yeah. That was it.
Thank you.
I suppose.
All right. How have you been?
Pretty good, but it's a lot of traveling.
It sounds like it.
Yeah, it's to Toronto is a big commute.
Yeah, it really is.
How long is the flight?
It's 5 hours, but I'm basically never more than 3 days anywhere.
What's that like?
For the last 3 years.
What?
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm lucky, I spend a week somewhere.
Whoa.
And then I go.
Yeah.
I think last year I was able to get 2 weeks straight on a vacation after Shape. And then my hope is in August to spend 10 days off.
Yeah.
But normally it's like this. It's like, because we have, I'm opening, I have 2 scholarships active in Mexico for kids to study film and animation and all that.
Oh, amazing.
And we're opening a stop-motion facility for animation students. Mm-hmm. And we have one of the scholarships is with a school in Paris. And Toronto, I'm keeping Toronto active with 2 movies that I'm producing. I'm doing an animated series on Netflix again and again. So it's like that.
Yeah.
So where were you born?
Guadalajara, second city in Mexico. Mm-hmm. There's Mexico City and then Guadalajara.
Right.
We are right now, I think, 8 million, and Mexico City is what, 24 or something like that. Yeah.
And what did your parents do when you were born?
My mother was a housemaker, and my dad was mainly a car dealer. Like he had dealerships. Oh. And had a lot of real estate. And when I talk about my father and I say my mother is a homemaker, well, let me clarify. My mother didn't work for a living, but she was also sort of a witch. Like she read the tarot and palmistry, the tea leaves. She learned with the gypsies. Like she would go with the gypsies to learn to read the tea leaves and the tarot and blah blah blah.
How did that all start?
I don't really know. It started when I was very young, and my mother would leave home, and she would come back, and there would be gypsies in the house playing guitar.
Amazing.
Yeah, and then she was sort of a bohemian. You know, she painted, wrote poetry. Wrote stories.
How much did you two bond around art and, you know,
making art? Not that much, because what happens is, what was good is that growing up like I did, I'm sure she was a counterpoint to my father's probably even fears about, you know, what is this kid going to ever do practically, you know? He must have been very puzzled. The significant thing is my dad, when I was 4, in 1968 or 69, he won $6 million in the lottery. He won the big lotto.
Wow!
How old were you?
I was 4.
You were 4. And what was the family's economic status before that?
We were middle class. Yeah. He already was a partner in a couple of dealerships, but he expanded enormously. But he was always, all the way to the end, my father was very, very blue-collar about us. Mm-hmm. Like, he raised us very, very much, you want this?
Work for it.
Well, how did, you know, you read this, I think the statistics are that lottery winners generally have a terrible time of it.
Oh, yeah, and everybody that made money, he and another 8 people, I think, won the lottery. Mm. And he's the only one that kept the money. Or enhanced.
Meaning, like, didn't blow it all?
He didn't blow it all.
What did he do with it?
He kept buying dealerships.
He invested it.
He bought a lot of real estate. And, you know, whenever we used to work with him in the summer, like, he would say, look, we're going to go on a trip. If you want money to spend, you know. And, like, I remember cleaning he had in the dealerships. He had a huge warehouse of spare parts. Mm-hmm. And it would take me 4 weeks with the equivalent of Windex and a rag, but I would clean the whole warehouse, you know, or wash all the cars.
Yeah, and then you'd earn your spending money.
And then he would say, this is your salary, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And when he would loan us money, he would either charge a minimal interest or he would ask, like, It was. But I think I think that's where I got my discipline, number one, you know, which I still have.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but it was a big change. All of a sudden, we went from living in a regular home to living in a house that was gigantic. Mm-hmm. So
there were changes to your lifestyle.
And I think the house was haunted. I do believe that. Mm. I don't know why, but I think it was haunted. And part of those changes is he bought a library of books he never read. Hmm. He had a big office with a huge library with a bunch of volumes that he never read. Mm-hmm. And I read them all when I was very, very young.
Like what?
I read an entire encyclopedia of art. I read an entire encyclopedia of health. Uh-huh. I read most of an encyclopedia.
Uh-huh.
So I was curious about
and this everything. Is when you were, what, like between 5 and...
Between 5 and 7, right?
Yeah. Wow,
cool. I read all the literature classics. Mm-hmm. I learned to speak English with a dictionary and American magazines and the Universal movies and all that. But this was 68, 69, mm-hmm. you know? It's when the big changes came.
And what did having that influx of wealth do to you, like socially with your peers?
I got bullied a lot.
Yeah.
And then that's part of the reason I gained weight.
Huh.
Because I was super thin.
Huh. When did that happen?
Early in primary school, mm-hmm. you know, probably second grade, third grade.
You gained weight to have more...
To be able to
more,
fight
to defend
more.
Yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Was that a will, like a conscious decision?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much so. Now I don't get into fist fights, but I need to lose it, you know.
But did you get... You were, like, working out, or you were just...
No, I was just...
You were just bulking out.
Enjoying the enchiladas, right?
Yeah.
But I remember, it was a lot of the violence when you're a kid in Mexico. It was very, very serious. Mm-hmm. It was your parents never took it seriously, but you knew it was really serious. Like they would hit each other with a stake. Mm-hmm. And a kid stabbed another kid with a compass, with the sharp end of a compass,
shit.
Once, you know, in the belly, and that was really bad. And this kid said to me, "I'm gonna." When we go, because we took some classes on the second floor mm-hmm. of the school, and he said, "When you're least expecting, I'm gonna throw you over the rail."
Oh Jesus!
And if they ask me, I'm gonna say we were playing blah blah. Unless you,
terrifying.
But then Monday comes, I came in and we got into a fist fight, and it didn't. Mm-hmm. It didn't take. it didn't take. But you have to.
Yeah.
It's not that you choose to, mm-hmm. but you have to. You know. I remember when I was a very 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 young, we went to the inauguration of a huge bridge mm-hmm. that crossed the canyon, mm-hmm. right? And all the adults were in a picnic, and I saw a bunch of the kids of my age carrying a baby to the edge of the cliff, and I went and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "We're gonna throw him over the edge to see how he." Becomes a little dot like in the Roadrunner cartoons.
Oh, what?
My God.
And I said, "No, but he's gonna die." And they said, "No, he's gonna bounce."
Wait.
Said, what was on the bottom?
The chasm.
Was it just so abstract to them?
Yeah, it was completely abstract to them. They were not.
There was nothing malicious
there
about
was nothing
it.
There was something semi-malicious, but there was no, they were not trying to kill the baby, but they were going to kill the baby. And I ran with the adults and I said, "They're gonna throw him over." And the adults, said, "You play with them, that's not true." But I knew, and that gave me an enormous amount of anguish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I knew they were going to throw the baby, so I had to go and explain to them that he wouldn't bounce, that, you know, it would die. And they, you know, everybody made fun of me, but they didn't throw the baby.
You sort of describe your childhood as being having a general feeling of being unsafe.
Yeah.
And so I guess I want to understand where your mom fit into that, because it sounds like she was in some ways a safe place. She may have understood you most of all.
They were very absent. Mm. And that's why I grew up mostly with my grandmother,
okay.
who was very Catholic.
Okay.
And my father and my mother, when my father came up on money, they started traveling a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And they bought an apartment in Mexico City,
mm-hmm.
which was like the New York of Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very cosmopolitan, very bohemian. And my mother started spending more time there than in Guadalajara.
Mm.
And I started spending more time with my grandmother, who was...
That was your maternal grandmother?
It was my maternal great-aunt, what we call her grandma.
Got it. Yeah.
And she's the one that was like Piper Laurie and Gary.
Yeah.
She was super, super, super Catholic.
Where did you feel most safe as a child?
Well, I didn't feel safe most anywhere because...
So it sounds like...
Well, there was that whole... notion of original sin, for example, and sin in general. When my grandmother explained to me that I was going to burn in hell, and I said, but burn, and she says, burn. It's not a metaphor. You're going to burn.
Alice is so gnarly in that regard.
Yeah, and in that, she said, you're going to be in a fire.
Yeah.
Your flesh is going to burn to a crisp, and then you're going to heal in the fire and burn again. Mm-hmm. And I said, how long? And she said, for hundreds of years. If you're good. If you're not good, millennia.
That's if you're good? Yeah, that's what she believed?
Yeah, no, well, she said that you have to be for a long, long time. And the more you mortify your flesh, the more you will atone. Right. You know, so she used to put... upside bottle caps on my shoes for my feet to bleed.
Wow.
And I was a little child. And she would say, this will amortize your time in purgatory.
Wow.
You know, so you get a sense of spiritual danger at all times. And that's Alfonso Cuarón makes fun of me. He says, you, in all your movies, the happy ending comes after people die. And I go, and he says, you're so Catholic.
Yeah.
You know, and in a way, it is true because of that. So I had no sense of an inner sanctum, you know, or a place that I could, like all my life when I would go to sleep, because my father was also very paranoid after winning the lottery.
Mm-hmm.
And my father used to wake us up if there was any noise at night. He would wake up all the kids, and we were 7, 8, 9, and he would take us to the windows and say, if you see anyone moving in the garden, yell.
Wow.
You know, and somebody broke in. And 90% of the time, nobody had broken in.
But wait, what about the other 10%?
Well, that's where I'm going to.
Okay.
And then when I was like 10, he pulled my brother, and he gave each of us a gun. He gave us a 9mm. And he said, if you see anyone moving in the garden, shoot. And I didn't see anyone, but I did hear somebody shooting at the end of the house. And I went, and somebody was jumping over the fence, the stone fence, the stone wall. And the one night watchman had shot. Because the house was back then so big that
we had
a night watchman.
Wait, who fired the gun?
A night watchman.
Did he shoot the guy?
Yeah.
Did he kill him?
No, he shot him in the leg. And the guy jumped back and ran away.
Wow.
But so what I'm trying to say is, pedagogically, I was not raised by people with a lot of... they were not exactly looking for the best...
Yeah.
Most hold some way to instill confidence in me. So when you ask that question, the answer sadly is nowhere.
Nowhere. So every figure in your life that's supposed to be providing safety and comfort was warning you of the dangers.
Of inherent dangers.
Yeah.
Right.
Was there anyone that felt?
No, not really.
Your siblings?
Not until I was much older. Like I had an uncle that I was named after him and my grandfather, Guillermo. And my uncle and I loved horror movies. He took me to see Taxi Driver the week of release.
Oh,
so
shit.
So I was very young.
This is a very good uncle.
Yeah. He took me to all the Hammer movies when they were coming out.
And how old were you when you
I was very young. Look, yeah. I mean, I must have been 9, mm-hmm. 10, mm-hmm. you know, and he would take me to see, like, Kuroneko, the Japanese mm-hmm. movie,
oh,
Onibaba.
One of my favorites.
Oh, my
you
God.
Know, he would take the opening wow. weekend, yeah. and my uncle would go with me. Mm-hmm. He is the one that started me in discussing occultism and this and that. He was wow. a good pal, wow. But he was, unfortunately, an alcoholic. Oh. And he died of or internal organ failure when I was still very...
Oh, no.
I was like probably 12, 13.
How 14. Much time did you spend with him when he was alive?
A lot. Yeah. He was a...
Like
he,
weekly?
Yeah. Weekly or bi-weekly, I would be with him. And he... Like, I think he was the first ghostly experience I ever had. Because him and I said, whoever dies first, of course,
one of those.
God tells the other that there's something beyond.
Yeah.
But of course, I was like 10.
Yeah. He was the odds were.
I was hedging my bets. and one night, I inherited his room in the house because he had a room in the house.
He lived with you guys.
No, it was called the guest room.
Yeah.
You know. And it was, but when I grew older, like 12, my brother and I couldn't stand being in the same room, mm-hmm. you know, because I wanted to listen to the radio at 11 and he wanted to, or vice versa, right? Mm-hmm. So my mother said, you take the guest room that used to be your uncle's. I took the guest room and I was I was watching a TV, you know, in a red Telefunken TV, really cheesy.
Those things are so cool.
Yeah, and red acrylic, you know.
Yeah.
And I was watching it, and all of a sudden I heard a breathing next to my ear. And I turned off the TV, and there was a disembodied voice, like sighing, like really sad.
Mm.
Very sad sigh. And I moved around the room, and the voice moved with me. So and I then thought, oh, you know, I thought it's him, and I got really scared and ran. I put my ear to the mattress and I heard it inside the mattress bouncing in the
coils.
Springs.
Wow. Yeah.
And I thought this is not normal, and I ran away and I thought it's him, and I never went back to that room. My salvation came from reading, because that's where I found kinships. Mm-hmm. Like I found kinship with Mark Twain, or I found kinship with Robert Louis Stevenson, or I found kinship with Herman Melville, or you know, all these books that spoke about the world, and particularly I found kinship with horror, the magazine Famous Monsters of Film.
Sure. Yeah. When did that start?
Well, I started reading it right away.
Yeah.
I mean, I think at age 7, the first book I bought was an anthology of horror stories by Forrest J. Ackerman.
Yeah, sure, right.
Forrey had edited it. Yeah, Forrey was, as everybody knows, it was the agent for many of the great sci-fi and horror writers of the era, and he put together this anthology. And at the end of the anthology, it said, "You can write me to this address or call this number and to contact me." Mm. And Forrey was very, very beautifully public about that, you know? I was reading Famous Monsters and I thought, these guys like the same things I do. Everybody else thought I was the weirdest kid ever, you know? Like I didn't play football. I was, you know, I would button my shirt all the way to the top button, you know.
It's like you.
Yeah, like you. And I would be like, really, really. I am still very shy. People laugh when I say this because I don't look shy, but I've been trained.
Right.
I'm self-trained to not be shy, mm-hmm. but I'm incredibly. I live out very. I like isolation. And I wrote to Forey. I wrote Forey a letter in English saying, could you please adopt me? Because my parents are completely wrong for me. And my father found the letter.
Oh, shit.
And my brother translated it. And my father beat the crap out of me.
Oh, wow. That's actually not that funny, but...
it is in retrospect.
It is in retrospect.
Well, I was just telling him in the car on the way over, and I don't expect you to remember this story, but in 2001, I had just written and directed my first film, and we were at Austin Film Festival together, and you were there with Devil's Backbone, and we were, you know, doing photos together, and I was very nervous to meet you, and I finally approached you in the lobby, and I just introduced myself and explained I had a movie, and I tried to quickly get out of your hair, and you stopped me, and you took a pen out of my hand, and you wrote your phone number down on a piece of paper, and you said, don't lose this. And you went back to L.A., and I went back to New York. And I called you, and you answered, and you remembered me. And you just kept me on the phone with you throughout your whole morning. You were getting coffee, you got your breakfast, and we were just chatting, and sometimes you weren't even talking to me. And I heard you having interactions with other people. You were arriving at some office, and I think we had a few phone calls and exchanged some emails, and I think, you know, it's a big part of why I think your generosity of spirit with me has led in many ways to, we try and behave that way when we can, and just to pay that forward, and just to try and have an open heart to every dreamer that you encounter, because you never know who
it's changed so much. You cannot be that way
anymore.
You have to be more focused. And like, I need to do it through the scholarship, I need to do it when you still do it, but there was a time when you could, and it was great, and I feel it's a loss or it's a change.
Well, what's changed?
Well, you know, like, let me put it, give you an example. When I wrote, in 1986, I wrote to Dick Smith. He was opening his makeup effects course.
I was going to ask about this.
Yeah, and I wrote him, and I said, look, I'm a kid from Guadalajara. I had an accident with my wife back then. I had an accident, and I was in bed from a motorcycle accident for a couple of weeks. I said, you know, I'm going to take this time to do pencil drawings of Kronos. And I'm going to send them to Dick Smith. Wow. And I sent the drawings to Dick Smith, and I said, I want to get into your course because I'm planning this movie, and no one can do the makeup effects except me if I learn. And he wrote back. He wrote back to a kid in Guadalajara. And he said, look, you're not very good, but you're very needy. you're my good act. He says, so come and learn.
Yeah.
And I learned with him, and it was the same thing.
In Los Angeles?
Or? No, in New York, Largemont. But I went to New York, and Dick Smith came and met me at the train station.
Wow.
He took me to lunch. He showed me all the makeup effects, material from The Exorcist, gave me a piece of Amadeus prosthetics, took me back to the train. Like, he was such a gentle man.
Yeah.
And I tried to do that, but I got to do it in an organized way, because right now, the thing is that I feel that you need to, for any legal multitude of reasons, you need to be more careful and more organized, you know? And unfortunately, that layer has to be there.
Yeah.
It used to be much simpler.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you're not giving your phone number out anymore.
No, you can't. You can't.
Yeah, I know.
You can't. You really can't. Because you're really doing a disservice to reality. Mm-hmm.
What was it like winning the Oscar?
Well, you know, I think that what you, what, because I was at the Oscars before with Pan's Labyrinth, you know, and back then the odds were saying it was going to win. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think it was going to. I didn't know. And that you cannot speculate, but from the outside people speculate. But when you're inside, all these dominoes are in motion, and you, and then you come to the ceremony, and you don't know. You don't know.
So you had no expectation.
No, people think you this or that, and but you go in and you know.
Yeah.
I learned it with bands,
right?
Where, you know, the Lives of Others, which is a fantastic movie, won, and. I felt an enormous relief because I said, I finally can remove my shoes. Super tight, you know? But you go in and then everything happens. And when you go up, the one thing you realize, especially in my case, you never knew you wanted it until you get it, you know? And wow. Then you realize that there's something, because what the cameras never see, like we got a beautiful ovation when I won director, but that's what the camera sees, but what they don't see is what you see from the stage, which is you see a sea of your peers, mm-hmm. you know, and a sea of people that you look up at, that you admire, that you work with, that you meet with, all at once. In front of you, and that's a very different point of view. And there's something very beautiful that happens then.
Were you present when it happened? Were you out of body?
I was very present.
And what were you? Were you? How strong were your emotions?
I was. I mean, look. The two things that I did, I said, look, don't prepare any speech.
Oh, really?
No, the only speech that I had was in the Golden Globes.
Uh-huh.
And I started reading and I said, hey, this doesn't work.
Yeah.
I just discarded it. And from then on, I said, just be there and be real about your emotions. And by all means, I'll tell you a little story. When Pan's Labyrinth showed the penultimate day at Cannes. Most of the press had left.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty empty, blah, blah, but the theater was full, completely full. And we got what still is, I think, the record at Cannes. And if you look at the at the recorded for the standing ovation, blah, we got 23 minutes.
Are you kidding me?
23 minutes.
No, that's exhausting.
Which and the first 5 minutes, I was not there. I was like, acting, and Alfonso was there, and Alfonso reached over and grabbed me by the arm and said, let them love you, stupid fucker. And I let it in.
Yeah.
And he was right. And then I literally just opened, and I was very present for another 13 minutes. I was very present, and I really was there. I was feeling it. I was bathing in it.
Wow.
And from then on, if anything goes well, I am there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very present. I'm not thinking. I'm not.
You're taking it in.
No, and I take it. And what I did know is my father's illness. And after, before the movie was finished, I said, I'm taking a year off. Mm-hmm. Because to me, Shape of Water was a very, very personally important movie. Mm-hmm. And I said, whatever happens, I want a year off. I don't want to work. Mm-hmm. And I knew I was going to take it, and I think it's good if you jump immediately into the next movie, it's not a good idea. Mm-hmm. I don't think. You know, I've been absent of many things in my life to fulfill professional obligations, right? And when my dad was going, I said I gotta be. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be in pre-production because the way I'm trained is I can't leave a production. I can't. I mean, even if I try.
Yeah.
No matter what happens. Yeah. Like, if something terrible happens on Wednesday, I'll be there Saturday.
Yeah.
And I can't, it would take enormous conflict. And I said, you know, I'd rather not shoot anything and stay free and be open to be with him. And I was able to be by his side like six times that looked like the final time.
Oh, my goodness.
And every time he would make it on, until the last one.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
So how was he proud of your success?
Yeah. No, yeah. I honestly, my dad was always, he never quite understood film, mm-hmm. you know? I remember his comment on Kronos, mm-hmm. if you've seen it. Mm-hmm. You know, he said, that's a masterpiece, my son. I said, well, that's good. You rarely go to movies, so high praise. There's only one thing that is not clear. I said, what? What was that golden little thing? The whole point of it.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
But his review of Terminator 2, because he saw Terminator 2 before we saw it, and I said, Dad, how's the movie? He says, everything explodes and a guy turns to water.
That's actually a great review.
I told it to Jim Cameron. He said, that's a pretty accurate
review. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, but he held the Oscar.
Oh,
and goodness. And I swear to you, this is the first time he went, oh, he makes movies, you know? Because I won many other awards on the way, you know. I won the, with Kronos, I won, we won, I think, six Mexican Academy Awards, and we won the Critics Week in Cannes, and this and that. But he never quite landed.
Mm. Was that frustrating?
No, because my dad was so different to me. I think that the key is either you love someone the way they are, mm-hmm. or move away, mm-hmm. get the hell away. Mm-hmm. Both things are valid. Mm-hmm. You can say, look, I'm not gonna be much in contact. We are like oil and water, and that's fine.
Sure.
Or you embrace the person as they are. And my dad, I thought that's the way he is. Mm-hmm. My brother says it very beautifully. When he was alive, my brother used to say, "He's not the flu. He's not gonna get better."
He's not the flu.
Yeah.
There's not gonna be a Monday where you go, "Oh, he now understands everything." It's your father.
Sure.
It's your father.
Yeah. What are your religious beliefs now?
I believe wholeheartedly that everything, within the entropy there is order, and within the order there is entropy, and it's sort of a Chinese box of order and chaos, mm-hmm. you know?
The yin and the yang.
Yeah, I do believe that there is a built-in cyclic balancer, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. that makes sure that there's always chaos, but there's always order to mm-hmm. to contain it mm-hmm. to a point. Mm-hmm. And not that the historical, like I don't think human history is the parameter. I don't think we'll see order in our lives as a species even. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. There is a passage in the Island of Dr. Moreau mm-hmm. in which there is a beautiful reflection that says, these are the beasts that were created, and the creator knew, I'm paraphrasing horribly, okay, but basically saying they were, Moreau knew that these were basically beasts, and yet all the commandments that govern them were against that very nature. Mm-hmm. And that in a nutshell is humanity.
Yeah.
And I think I believe that if we make peace with the fact that we have to reconcile all our differences and exist, coexist, know that we are the same and different. It's a very complicated thing to do and a very adult thing to do, and I don't think we are an adult society. I think we are a teenage. We went from the infantile quartering and dismembering of the hordes in medieval times, or the many conquests of many countries, to sort of a semi-articulate, semi-civilized, still brutal coexistence. And I think, but eventually we may behave like adults. Mm-hmm. The 60s in Mexico are the 40s in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are much more conservative, mm-hmm. you know, much more behind you know, and incredibly Catholic. Mm-hmm. So I was raised with this notion that that there was an order and that there was a God and everything was benign and that everything was fine. But then on the newspapers or everyday life, you saw things that didn't correspond. You know what I'm saying? The things that didn't match, they didn't add up. And horror spoke about the whole other side. And I thought, I think I can trust this more than the other narrative. You know, I think I can trust more the monstrosity than the virtue. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I think that it's a cousin of mine was kidnapped when I was seven and murdered.
Oh, Jesus.
And when my grandma sat us down and explained us, Toño, little Antonio, is dead, and he was strangled with a rope and thrown into a sack and thrown into a river, and they just found him. And, you know, I had no way to reconcile those things with what they were saying, you know?
Right.
And horror completed the picture. Everybody was talking about the yin, and I was missing the yang.
Yeah.
And when I found the yang, I thought, this is more real, or at least more based on reality than this other thing. We may aspire to the yin.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Do you have time to show us around a little
bit? Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
No problem.
Great.
That concludes part one of our visit with Guillermo del Toro. Please join us for part two, in which you'll hear Guillermo say,
"One of the things I like the most in this life is vacuum cleaning."